Thank you very much for coming. The test is always the second week. You know, the first week, so people are curious. And the question is, who comes back for week number two? I also want to note, because I forgot last time, but if anyone is interested in being added to the email list for programs for the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah and Beit Midrash, please email me. You can see my email address is right there at the top of the page. So send me an email. We'll be glad to add you to the email list. And, of course, that's free. The topic for this week is actually a rather grim topic. Not that last week wasn't, actually. But this one, this is actually, it's a very difficult topic to address, because we're so tied into it personally. It's the issue of use of data from the Nazi experiments that were conducted during the Holocaust. Unfortunately, this isn't a question you can really address on a purely intellectual level. It ties into every Jew on such a basic human level. Take a look, please, at source number one. I'm not going to read it out loud. It's too gruesome to read out loud. Read it yourself, please. And you'll see the way Baruch Cohn put this in his discussion about the ethics of using medical data from Nazi experiments. That's the title of his study on it. The study is actually available on the website jlaw.com. And you see the terminology that he uses, and that's it. That's why this is such a hard topic to address. At the same time, despite the difficulty of addressing this, you know, it's sort of tempting just to write it off and say, well, forget it, we're not going to address it, don't use the data, case closed, beginning, middle, and end. The problem with that is that the data retrieved from those experiments actually is important data. In other words, it's not as though all the information out of those experiments was useless. Take a look at source number two, for example. And this comes also from Baruch Cohn's article that's available on the jlaw.com website. If I could ask you to read, please.
Sure.
Thanks.
As part of their research, the EPA scientists analyzed how different doses of phosgene affected the lungs, particularly of the people living around the manufacturing plants that processed the gas. They found that except for local irritation to the skin, eyes, and upper respiratory tract, the lungs could be considered the target organ of phosgene gas. Even as intermediate and low concentrations, phosgene destroys enzymes in the lungs. This causes fluid buildup and can lead to death by drowning.
I'm going to pause you for 1 second. The EPA scientists looked at the impact of living near plants that process phosgene gas. And they discovered, lo and behold, you know what? Living near those plants is bad for you. What they also discovered...
From
the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency. I'm an American, so I just take it as a given. Right, so the connection is what's coming in the next paragraph. That EPA study is a modern study done after people already had problems living near those plants. Now take a look at the next paragraph.
The experimental study on the acute toxicity of phosgene on humans was performed during World War II. The Nazi phosgene data could have saved the lives of the residents who live near the manufacturing plant. Should the EPA have used the Nazi data or ignore it? Upon learning of the draft study's references to the Nazi data, former EPA Chief Administrator Lee Thomas decided that the agency should not use the data. Thomas's decision came after he received a letter signed by 22 EPA scientists protesting the use of Nazi data. Thomas's knee-jerk reaction to the prospects of the Nazi data's use is typical, professional, especially when human lives are at stake. The Nazi data could be critical to saving known victims' lives.
Right. So they had done this research. Now, how did they do this research? How did they come up with this information? By experimenting on Jews. I mean, that's where this knowledge comes from. And so the question is, can you use that information? Or is there something inherently corrupt about the information because of the way it was obtained, the cost of obtaining it? I'm going to pass this sheet that way so you can have one. So that's the question that we need to address. Now, here I want to divert for a second to talk about how we determine Jewish ethics altogether. Where do Jewish ethics come from? Those who were at Rosh Hashanah's shiur this morning heard a little bit about it. It's important that we understand that Jewish ethics are not simply ethics devised by Jews. They're ethics that come from the Torah, from our Torah sources. Otherwise, anyone can come up with any idea and say, well, that's an ethic. If you take a look at source number 3 on your sheet, from Eleanor Singer, who puts it very simply, very concisely, she says it is nonsense to talk about enforcing ethical standards as though these were clear and agreed upon. Whose ethics are to be adopted as a standard? Right? Anybody can say, I think this is right, I think this is wrong. We have an objective system, and that system is the Torah, and that's what we're supposed to look at. We look at the halachos that are in the Torah, we look at the stories that are in the Torah, and they're meant to teach us what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to behave. Granted that there's always some vagueness in terms of how to interpret, what lesson am I supposed to draw out of the story. Nonetheless, if I can honestly deduce a lesson from a story in the Torah, from a halacha in the Torah, and it's consistent with the rest of Torah, now I have found the Jewish ethic. Rosh Hashanah Rafael Hirsch makes that point in his introduction to his work Chariv. Hirsch discusses the difference between what he calls Shmaitza and Agadata. Shmaitza is legal, a legal section of the Torah, where the Torah says, do this or don't do that. Agadata is anything within the Torah that does not say, do this or don't do that, but instead is a story, but instead is some account of history. And Hirsch says, anybody can deduce a lesson from Agadata as long as it doesn't contradict Shmaitza. So, for example, classic example, Shiluach HaKein, there's a mitzvah in the Torah of sending away the mother bird. I can deduce lessons for my own behavior from this mitzvah of sending away the mother bird. I'm not supposed to ascribe attributes to God. I can't say God is merciful in telling me to send away the mother bird before taking the young. But I can say that Hashem wants to teach me to be merciful, because that's consistent with the rest of Torah. So I can deduce an ethic from that halacha of Shiluach HaKein. And that's what we do. We look in the Torah, and we try to determine what the Torah is telling us about the way we're supposed to live our lives. So, let me give you an example. We're going to see it a little bit later. The story of Chizkiah and the Sefer Refuos. In the days of King Chizkiah, there was a book that was around called the Sefer Refuos. Sefer Refuos means? Book of health, book of cures, book of healing, right? Essentially a medical text. And Chizkiah banned it. He said, get rid of this book. Why did he say get rid of the book? Take a look, please, at source number 4 for one explanation. We're going to see another explanation later on. This is Rashi's explanation. He says, so that people would pray for mercy. In other words, people came to trust the medicine to such an extent that they said, well, then why daven? You sick? No problem. Go take this medicine, undergo that therapy, and you'll get better. The shades, I suppose, of my own shear from this morning on the obligation of a physician to heal. But that's something that people would do. They wouldn't daven. Instead, they would just try to heal themselves. Well, that teaches me a lesson. It teaches me an ethic from there, specifically, that I'm not supposed to only rely on my own means. I'm also supposed to rely on Hashem. A simple and basic lesson, to be sure. But it emerges out of that story of Chizkiah banning the book. There are other ethics that we could derive from other sources, but I think it's pretty clear what I'm getting at here. The key is to work with Jewish sources. But there's a twist. Take a look, please, at source number 5. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin. We do not seat a judge in the Sanhedrin unless he can argue from biblical sources that a sheretz is pure. There are 8 shratzim, creepy, crawly creatures, lizards of various kinds, for which the Torah says they communicate impurity. Well, you don't qualify for a seat on the Sanhedrin unless you can argue, using sources from the Torah, that a sheretz is actually pure. Why? Why is this my standard? In order to be a judge, you have to be able to tell me that chazer is kosher. Why does the... Yeah, it's a similar idea. Why is this... What is our expectation of the judge? What skill is this judge developing, maybe or displaying in this exercise? Can anyone think why we would want a judge to be able to do this?
Ability to argue.
Ability to argue, right, because Jews have to be able to argue, and a judge has to be able to argue with Jews, so it's even better. Encyclopedic knowledge of Torah. Devil's advocate. I don't know if that's exactly what you were trying to say, but to show that he could argue as a devil's advocate, that's very important. The Torah has a mitzvah of Yitzilu Ha'edas HaRotzeach. In a capital case, the judges are obligated to try to save the defendant, even where, intuitively, they know he's guilty. So much so, that if the Sanhedrin votes in a capital case, and their initial vote comes out 23-0 for guilt, we throw the case out. Forget it. Because clearly no one is trying to fulfill Yitzilu Ha'edas HaRotzeach. The deck is stacked to try to find the defendant innocent. So we need a judge who's going to be able to say, I saw him, you know, I saw the center fielder shoot the right fielder in the middle of a game with 20,000 people there. You can give your own hockey metaphor if you like. But the judge has to be able to say, yeah, I heard that testimony and I still don't believe he's guilty. You need somebody who can argue that a sheretz is pure. So we have a few different reasons why we would require this of a judge: to show his knowledge, to show he can argue, to be a devil's advocate, perhaps to show a logical mind without preconceived notions. He's not walking in with any assumptions. But the Torah Tamima, or Baruch Halevi Epstein, has a very interesting comment on Parshas Shemini. He says, this is a requirement for judges, because we need to understand that the Jewish approach is at times counterintuitive. Meaning, there are times when every instinct of mine, as a human being, and even as a Jew, will say, do X, say this, whatever it is, and the Torah is going to say, don't do it. It's not what we do. That's not a Jewish ethic, even though I believe it is. So the judge is called upon to be able to run counter to his own logic, that he's going to argue the sheretz is pure and still come out with a ruling the sheretz is not pure, the sheretz is tamei. That's the idea, that the judge needs to be able to overrule himself. And that is a major issue in Jewish ethics. To be able to say, instinctively I think X, but you know what? Based on this source in the Torah, I'm going to say Y. That's a very important point when it comes to this very personal topic of the use of the data from the experiments. Because what I'm going to show, using arguments from Rabbi J. David Bleich, is that this issue is not open and shut at all. Despite the horror that we're talking about, the way this data was gained by torturing our families, it's yet possible to make the argument within Jewish ethics that the data is usable. So we start from square one, the experiments themselves. The phosgene gas is one example. Another example is recovery from hypothermia, where they would expose Jews to extreme cold, and then see whether they could recover from the cold. They would pump air out of the room and see how long it took them to suffocate. Those are the Nazi examples. There are other examples that have come up in Western society since then. I made reference last week to the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, so I'll use that as an example. In 1932, the United States Public Health Service initiated what was called the Tuskegee Syphilis Study to document the natural history of the disease. The subjects of the investigation were 399 poor black sharecroppers from Macon County, Alabama, with latent syphilis, and 201 men who did not have the disease, who served as a control. While the physicians who conducted the study deceived the men, telling them they were being treated for what they called bad blood. They deliberately denied treatment to the men who had the disease, and they went to great lengths to ensure that they would not receive therapy from any source. In exchange for their participation, the men received free meals, free medical examinations, and gruesomely, burial insurance. This is not Nazi Germany. I mean, this is you know, America in the 1930s. They developed later the 10 rule. It's an odd title for this, but that's the title. The 10 rule Nuremberg Code of Ethics. The Nuremberg part is just very ironic. And today there's a system of protective ethics in place, as recommended by the New England Journal of Medicine, to prevent that sort of thing from happening. If you take a look, I think I brought it here. No, I did not. I'm sorry. But there's the system of medical of protective ethics essentially involves, number one, informed consent, as we discussed last week. Number two, that a placebo will not be used if there is good reason to believe that the treated group will fare better. And number three, that any appreciable risk must be outweighed by commensurate benefit. And clearly you need a team of people to evaluate this. But that's the system today. So here's our question. Can we use the data or not use the data? There are four issues I'd like to address. Number one, the issue of healing someone via murder, because really that's what we're talking about, healing people today via the torture that was done back then. Number two, benefiting from a corpse, benefiting from, in this case, the bodies of the people who were harmed. Number three, encouraging future unethical research. If we make use of that data, are we now encouraging people in the future to say, well, you know what, I'll do this first and I'll ask questions later? And then number four, the very thorny question of, are we now partners of those, you know, barbaric scientists who did this by making use of their information?
May I interrupt you?
Please, by all means. I've been talking too long.
You're forgetting one point.
Okay.
That these experiments were only done for the benefit of the German people. Mm-hmm. They weren't done for the benefit of humanity.
Right. That's correct. I'm not. But why is that? How does that translate into what we're?
Well, because no one else. It wasn't shared the benefit with the whole world.
Right.
It wasn't written in a medical journal that the whole world should know about it. It was only to save the German soldiers, which were during the war,
right.
or the
army. Right. Right. And no one, I hope, would ever try to rehabilitate the reputation of the people who did this. I mean, they were doing it to save their own people. They were doing it in the most barbaric, inhuman, doesn't even begin to cover it way. I don't think anybody in the debate is looking to rehabilitate the reputation and say that these were upstanding people. But it's certainly true. Yeah, their motives were entirely selfish. And entirely barbaric. That's 100% true. You also touched on another point, which is not really within the scope of tonight's discussion, but since you mentioned it, I want to just also mention it. And that is the question of whether their data is reliable at all.
Yeah, the, something is so politicized. Mm-hmm. Don't you have to question whether, I mean, were they looking for things that would satisfy political masters?
Yeah. And
doesn't that make the data
satisfy the ideas of a political master and for the benefit of their own people?
Right, and it's also not exactly what we'd call peer-reviewed work. It doesn't go through the normal publication process. So that's certainly true. I'm taking as a given that the data is usable because that's really where the ethical question comes into play. But that's something which has been argued regarding the specific case of using their data. It could be their data is useless to us in any case simply because of the process by which it was obtained. It wasn't obtained in what we would consider an objective laboratory environment. That's certainly true. So let's look at the first issue. Healing via murder that we're talking about here. Take a look, please, on your sheets. Dr. Christine Moe writes, nor, however, should we let this, source number six, should we let the inhumanity of such experiments blind us to the possibility that some, quote, good may be salvaged from the ashes. She believes that we should indeed be using the data. However, she's, as you see there with the Hastings Center, that's really all I know about her. The Hastings Center did a whole study on this issue, consulting various authors. I quoted earlier Eleanor Singer from the same from the same journal, but they, it's been back and forth within their reports, or it was back and forth. This goes back, you know, 25, 30 years. The she argues that maybe you could salvage some good from these experiments, but we don't necessarily believe that. Not just in this case, but in general. Take a look, please, at source number 7. Tzigamar and Psachim. If I could ask someone to read. Michael, was it?
Very good. Actually, before I read it, though, I think the question's loaded. It says healing
yes.
via murder. That's encouraging murder. It doesn't say healing using the data of murder, which would be...
No, that's right. It's a step removed, and I'm going to come back to that.
Well, and the source from the Talmud talks about murder. So I was going to ask you whether the data from murder would necessarily be the same thing.
Good question. We're going to come back to it.
Everything may be used for healing, except idolatry, sexual immorality, and murder.
Right. Everything may be used for healing, right? So if somebody is deathly ill and he needs to eat chazer in order to survive, he can eat it in order to survive, except for the big three. Idolatry, sexual immorality, and murder. Those may not be used in order to heal somebody. I am not justified in killing one person in order to save another. For an example of that, I go back to, again, that story of King Chizkiah and the Sefer Refuos, the Book of Cures. He hides the book away. We saw one explanation for why he hid the book from Rashi. Rashi said he hid the book because people weren't davening anymore. The Rambam gives a different explanation. Take a look at source number 8, please. The Rambam writes, there are practices that God has forbidden, but that one may study and analyze. Meaning, things I'm not allowed to do, but I'm allowed to study. I can learn about them. For God only said, do not learn to practice them. And our tradition-based understanding, recorded in the Talmud in Sanhedrin 68, is that one may learn in order to analyze and teach. So in other words, there may be medical practices that are prohibited, but I'm allowed to study them because I need to know them. Even if I can't practice them, there may be some benefit that comes of them. You know what that reminds me of? The Rambam writes in his, in I think it's in Regimen Sanitatis, is where he writes this, that the most nutritious food in the world is, anyone guess? I'm sorry, maybe it's the most nutritious meat he might be talking about. Chaza. He says, pork is the most nutritious meat in the world. And you know what he says is the worst food in the world for you? Matzah. Matzah. That's what he writes. It has to do with the Rambam's medical theory of digestion. That's no surprise, probably, but that's where it comes in. But the Rambam's point regarding the most nutritious meat to eat, he says, is pork. Now, the Rambam is, you know, God forbid, he's not recommending that you eat it. But that's an example of him saying, we study therapies, even those that are not permitted to us. However, he says, when people destroyed their path, they corrupted their path and began to cure themselves through these means, the means that were prohibited, he removed the practices, he being King Chizkiah, and hid them away. According to the Rambam, the reason why Chizkiah puts away this book is because the book contains advice, healing advice, that we're not permitted to use. And people start using it. In other words, there are means of curing that are prohibited to us, that are banned, even though they could actually heal someone. And so the argument could be made that in this case, to heal someone now, using data that was collected through these torture experiments, is like healing somebody through murder. That's the argument that could be brought. However, Rabbi J. David Bleich argues the contrary, and this may be what Michael was referring to. He says, not necessarily. He says, the cases there in the Gemara talk about healing through murder directly. It's an immediate thing. In other words, the classic example, somebody comes up to you and threatens you and says, I'll do X to you unless you kill somebody else. That's the classic case. However, what we're talking about is after the fact. It's already happened. They're already deceased. The victims are already gone. So the argument could be made, this is not a proactive healing somebody through murder. The murder already happened. What we want to do is now use the data that was collected in order to be able to heal somebody now, and that may well be a second level. Michael, was that what you meant?
Yeah, you're one step removed. The question's like,
yes.
It says murder, but it's not the data.
Right. You had a question? Point?
Where's Pikuach Nefesh comes in?
Pikuach Nefesh does not override these concerns. That's exactly correct. Does not. That's correct. When we say Pikuach Nefesh overrides everything, we don't really mean everything. Pikuach Nefesh does not override not killing somebody else. Pikuach Nefesh does not override immorality. And Pikuach Nefesh does not override murder.
A question of personal healing, like Ethan Kazarov, or trying to help yourself because you're trying to nourish your body.
Right. So what the Rambam is talking about in this Sefer Refuos, this Book of Cures, is either cures that involve the big three, or he's talking about cures for diseases that aren't life-threatening. You know, a person has a chronic condition, and the book says in it he can eat chazer and get better, and he's doing that even though it's not halachically justified. Okay. That's our first issue. Our second issue comes from a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Take a look, please. At your sheet, source number 9. This is now the flip side of the sheet. If I can ask someone from that side to do me the favor of reading.
Okay.
Thank you.
One may not benefit from a corpse. How do I know this? From a biblical link between the burial of Miriam and the Ekalarufa.
Right. The textual link is too long and elaborate to go into right now, but the Torah links the burial of Miriam and the Egla Arufa. The Egla Arufa, the ritual that we go through with a calf when there's a body found outside of town, we don't know who murdered the person. So in that story, the calf ends up in a place which you're not allowed to work and from which you're not allowed to benefit. We can't benefit from the Egla Arufa. So we learn that just as you can't benefit from the Egla Arufa, so too you're not allowed to benefit from a dead body. That leads to all sorts of questions regarding organ donation. Yes, organ donation may well be permitted in various cases. That's not this class. We can do it in another class. We're just going to go from one gruesome topic to another. Maybe we'll do business ethics next time. The Gemara is saying that one is not allowed to benefit from a corpse. So am I indeed prohibited from benefiting from the data obtained in these experiments? The Chasam Sofer wrote explicitly in a tshuva dealing with autopsy issues and medical ethics in terms of training doctors, he says that prohibition includes looking at the body. I'm not allowed to look at the body in order to benefit. It's like a Mishnah in Nedarim, I brought it here on the sheet, that says that if a person vows not to benefit from another person, from someone else, he is prohibited from benefiting from the common property of that town. In other words, there's jointly owned property. I vowed I wasn't going to benefit from Reuven. Reuven lives in that town. I'm not allowed to benefit from Reuven's town's property. Because Reuven lives in the town. He is an owner of that property, including texts. Books that are owned by the town are off limits to me. All I'm going to do is read them. That's all I'm doing. I'm not taking the books and, I don't know what, showering, you know, using it. What's the big deal? Nonetheless, even reading those books is indeed off limits. So maybe the argument should be made that I'm not allowed to benefit from these experiments that were done. But again, Rabbi Bleich comes along and offers a counter-argument. What's the counter-argument? The knowledge here has already been acquired. I'm not going to the body and looking for signs of things and deriving something. It's already a step removed. The data's been collected. The observations have been made. My benefit is really know, at a remove from the bodies themselves. Take a look, please, at source number 11, where it's actually fairly clear. It's a Gemara Nida. Source number 11. David, can I ask you to read?
Cleopatra, queen of Alexandria, once had some maids who were up for execution. She checked and found that both the male and female fetuses inside them were formed by day 41. But perhaps those who were pregnant with female fetuses had become pregnant 40 days before the others. No, she gave them an abortive poison before the experiment.
Yeah, the source is a little opaque. Let me unpack it a little bit. Cleopatra had maids who were up for execution. Whether this is the big famous Cleopatra or another Cleopatra is irrelevant for our purposes. But she had some maids, and the maids were up for execution. We don't know the crime. We don't know what we're talking about. All we know is they were going to be executed. So she decided this is a fine time for some experimenting. And she checked and found that they were pregnant with male and female fetuses, and the male and female fetuses were formed to the extent that you could discern gender already in certain organs by day 41 of the pregnancy. To which the Talmud asks, well, how do you know that that was actually, you know, day 41 of the pregnancy? Maybe the female fetuses came from mothers who had become pregnant 40 days earlier, and maybe it takes 80 days for female babies to develop. The church had that idea. They took the psukim in the beginning of Parshas Tazria that talk about purity and impurity after a birth, 40 days for the male and 80 days for the female and the whole thing, and they applied it to gestation. And the church, the early church, decided that a male fetus was formed after 40 days in the womb, and a female fetus was formed after 80 days in the womb. That was their decision. It applied to early church doctrine on abortion issues. But the Gemara here says, how do you know that the female fetuses developed at the same rate as the male ones? Maybe the mothers who had female fetuses inside, in fact, had become pregnant much earlier? No. Cleopatra planned this so closely that she made sure to clear their system 40 days before the experiment, and she had them live with her slaves, and that's how they became pregnant. She planned the whole deal. Now, the sages record this in the Gemara. Where did they get this information? How did they know it? How did the word of this get to them? They're studying the data that she collected from corpses, right? I mean, she executes people and has them opened up and examines the fetus that's inside. And the sages have no problem writing down the information. Right? It's pretty clear. Take a look at source number 12.
But they're not going to use it. They're just quoting data. So there's an end point. I don't think that you can...
But what are they even doing having the data?
We're quoting it out of context. They may have quoted it to say how ruthless she was.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, no. If you look in the Gemara there, the Gemara actually has a use for it. It's not. It has to do with what we consider a fetus before day 40 and after day 40. And it has actually great great practical ramifications, halachically, in terms of how we treat abortion. Before 40 being Maya Ba'alma, it actually is quite relevant. Take a look at source number 12. Once, a box of bones, presumably this was an ossuary, I forget how to pronounce it, ossuary, the O-S-S-U-A-R-Y, pronounce it as you will. But once a box of bones was brought to the synagogue of the Tarsiyim. There's some debate as to who the Tarsiyim were, people from a certain area, coppersmiths, different explanations for it. But they have their own gathering place, and this box of bones was brought there, and they left it out in the open air. They didn't want to bring it in because of a concern for impurity for Kohanim. Thaddeus the doctor, Todus Harofe, and the other doctors came and declared, oh, this does not contain a complete spine from a single corpse. You don't have anything to worry about. It's not going to communicate impurity under the roof. And therefore the box can be brought inside without spreading impurity. So here, once again, the sages are using knowledge from doctors who must have some knowledge from autopsies. Otherwise, how in the world are they able to determine whether the spine is from one person or from multiple people? Someone's been doing autopsies. Now, that's actually a fascinating issue altogether, because from a secular perspective, in terms of secular culture, there was a taboo against autopsy in most cultures for a very, very long time, until relatively recently in history. So how they came about this information is interesting in its own right. Nonetheless, my point here is, and this is what the point that Rabbi Bleich makes, even though we don't benefit directly from a corpse, it seems that we are permitted to benefit from data somebody else collected from a corpse. And so to apply it again to our discussion, maybe again, the data is in fact within bounds. Third issue, encouraging future unethical research. Certainly we're obligated to do whatever we can to avoid promoting unethical behavior. However, Rabbi J. David Bleich points out that that really may not be relevant in this discussion at all. Take a look at source number 13 from Rabbi Bleich's article in his Contemporary Halachic Problems. He says, paradoxically, it is precisely because the Nazi experimentation or the notorious Tuskegee syphilis studies were so bestial that citation of data yielded by those studies will not serve as an impetus for the repetition of those horrendous practices. In other words, the fact that I'm willing to use that data isn't going to cause some doctor to say, I guess I'm free to conduct these experiments. It was so horrific that no one is ever going to believe this to be justified. Nor is refusal to cite those results likely to serve as a deterrent to a diabolically inclined madman. On the other hand, if you have someone who's going to do this, the fact that Torchiner says, I'm not using the data, isn't going to stop him from committing this kind of crime. Someone who's so depraved that he would do this isn't going to care whether we're using the data or not. To go back to your point about the Germans, you know, they're using this, you know, for the promotion of their army. They're not going to care whether the rest of the world is going to use the data or not. They're doing it for their own purposes. And then last, you come to the argument that by using the data, somehow we become partners to those scientists. And this is an argument that is put forth. Take a look at source 14 from Dr. Henry Beecher. He says, this loss, I mean the loss of not having the data, this loss, it seems, would be less important than the far-reaching moral loss to medicine if the data were to be published. So he wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine early on, back in the 60s. He says, there's a greater loss to medicine if we use this data than if we just throw the data out. We don't need the information that they have if it's going to come at this price. And that's the argument that Dr. Beecher made. Dr. Howard Spiro from the Department of Internal Medicine at Yale University argued that it's not an honor to the memory of the victims by learning from the experiments that were carried out on them. And instead, his term is, we make the Nazis our retroactive partners in the victims' torture and death by using it. Very strong terminology. Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz, writing in Jewish Medical Ethics, said that it's a dishonor to us and it's a dishonor to them, to the deceased, to use the data. It's a very strong argument personally, emotionally. But again, where is the Torah source for this concept? Going back to our point about Jewish ethics. Where do we find anywhere within the Torah where we say that if I benefit from the work done by a wicked person, I now become like a partner to him? The answer is we don't. Which is a strong thing to say, because you find pretty much anything. You look long enough in the Torah, there's an awful lot that you can find in there. Hafoch ba, hafoch ba, dekula ba, it's all in it. Nonetheless, we don't seem to have a source within the Torah to say that if I use his work, now I become like a partner to him.
It's the opposite.
Yeah.
The example of Mordecai and Haman. At the end of the story, Mordecai becomes the richest man in the town.
Right.
Because he's given Haman's wealth.
Right, so he's able to use Haman's wealth. Right, well, Korach, that's the Gemara Megillah. He gets it from Korach. But yeah, it's true. It's hard to find any source for this, so that even though it appeals as a personal ethic, it's hard to call that a Jewish ethic. So to summarize what we have, we have four concerns. One is that healing via murder is prohibited. The response to which is, yeah, but this isn't healing via murder. It's healing via the data that was retrieved from a murder that was already committed. The issue of benefiting from a corpse But again, we're benefiting from data that somebody else collected from a corpse, which we said, you know, was clearly permitted based on the Gemara itself. We talked about encouraging future unethical research, but it's highly questionable that my use of the data will encourage it, or my lack of use of the data will discourage that sort of experimentation. And then lastly, we talked about the issue of being a partner to those scientists. And again, it's hard to call this a Jewish ethic. What emerges from this is that it's not open and shut by any stretch of the imagination. Even though, I remember when I first started studying this issue, I thought for sure, well, how in the world could we ever use the data? The truth of the matter is that it's not so clear at all. Even though it horrifies me personally to think of using it, it's not so clear at all. I'm certainly not about to come out with an answer one way or the other. But the arguments, I think, have to be weighed carefully. Yes?
I'm wondering, actually, if you have to use the data at all, whether you could do your own ethical experiment and use the data as a kind of... I said use the data, but not use it, you know, directly, but almost indirectly. You could do your own experimentation in an ethical way and see if you come up with the same kind of result that would be the result that came from an actual... horrific experiment,
right,
that was done, an ethical experiment that was done that was more direct.
Right.
And you could say, well, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, it could be used, but maybe not used in a direct sense.
Right. It would be what we call Tana de Messiah. It would be a source that used for backup rather than the primary source. Yeah. Now, I hear that, and I think that would probably assuage some people's nerves over the issue. If the data is prohibited, that method doesn't work. If the data is fundamentally permitted, but we are just, you know, queasy about it, then that becomes a more palatable approach. Yeah, I would agree with that. I read that might help a little bit.
So you cannot use the byproduct directly from the sea human, like soap from human mains. You cannot use that.
Correct.
That is clear.
Yes.
So let's take an example. In Israel, do the medical students learn on divers?
Right, so that's an excellent, excellent question. That's a whole shiur unto itself as to whether and how and in what way it will be permitted. In short, medical students do. The question is it halachic, and if so, how? And I'm going to beg out right now because it's already 8:45, and I'm not going to start on that as a whole new topic now. But the answer, in short, is that it's highly controversial and probably a good topic for another year. I want to get a little bit away from the death topics for maybe for a week or two before we come back to like smoking, as we had talked about last week as another topic. Maybe we'll do business ethics for a couple of weeks in order to move away from this for a bit. Yeah, that sort of thing.
With the data, like I'm just reading from the Stefanida when you quote from Cleopatra, because in Isomenat case they're using non-Jews, or the maidservants are non-Jewish. Would that have any bearing on any of the data? Or is it, from an ethical point of view, would make a difference one human to the other, but halachically would it make a difference whether it's...
Right, so the answer, the prohibition against benefiting from the corpse would seem to pertain the either way, whether Jewish or not. Yeah. There is other discussion that relates to that, but that's the basic. Okay, well, thank you very much. God willing, we'll be here again next Sunday at 8 o'clock. The last class in the series, the one that's November 15th, we have to move to 9 o'clock. I hope that doesn't put it out of people's reach, or I hope it doesn't put people to sleep during the class. But I have a prior engagement that I need to be at earlier in the evening. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.